Welcome to Get in the Herd, a podcast about addiction and recovery brought to you by the McShin Foundation. If you or a loved one are looking for real discussions about addiction, recovery, stigma, advocacy, and most importantly, hope, then stick around. Thanks for joining us. Now sit back and get ready for another great episode of Get in the Herd.
Morning, everybody, and welcome to a special Friday morning episode of the award-winning recovery podcast, Get in the Herd. Today, our guest is filmmaker Greg Williams, and before I let Greg speak, I just want to throw all this good stuff about Greg out. Greg Williams is the award-winning, I like that, filmmaker of feature-length documentaries, The Anonymous People. That's a 2014 Prism Award for Prism Award for Outstanding Documentary, and Generation Found. In 2015, Greg produced the historic Unite to Face Addiction rally on the National Mall when tens of thousands of people from around the world gathered to end the silence surrounding addiction. This was the first time major musicians, politicians, actors, athletes, models, I like that, journalists, authors, and advocates joined together in unison to solve the most urgent healthcare crisis of our time. The event was memorialized in a PBS special, The Concert to Face Addiction, that Greg produced. He has also produced the launch event and companion TV special for the release of the first ever Surgeon General's Report on Alcohol, Drugs, and Health, Listen, Facing Addiction in America, when Viacom aired the special simultaneously on 11 of its cable networks, which was seen by millions. So, Greg, this begs the question, how on earth do you have time with all that going on to join us today? Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Nathan. And that was maybe one of the more energetic greetings of a bio that I've heard. So it's quite humbling. But the... It's great to be here, and I love what you're doing, and love everything down in Virginia, McShin, and I've learned so much from the crew that hangs out with the herd here, and you know, in terms of time, it's you just read 8-10 years, so you know, doing a couple things every now and then, but it's been a fun decade and learning about the recovery advocacy community and getting in the herd and trying to tell some parts of their story.
Well, welcome to the show. And I know that we could sit here and probably spend the entire hour with me just telling you how great I think that you are. And you probably don't know how great I think you are yet, but you will. However, we're here specifically to talk about a new project that's about to come out, and that is a feature documentary film called Tipping the Pain Scale. Greg, tell us about what you got going on.
Yeah, well, it's been a while, since I got a chance to dive in the film world, since Generation Found came out in 2016. And you know, it's one of those things in storytelling where, just like writing, you have to be kind of called to the project or called to the story. And, Tipping the Pain Scale is a project that kind of happened organically, started pre-production in 18 and 19. And what it was the sense that, as much progress as we've made, in recovery support services and recovery organizing, since the Anonymous People came out. I mean, there's just been this dramatic change in our drug supply and the poison drug supply and what's happened as a result of fentanyl and what's happening in our communities and the inner cities and the suburbs and it's just it's really tragic and sad. Obviously, we're talking the same week that the CDC releases the 100,000 number of the last 12 months of people who've lost their lives to just overdose. Doesn't even include alcohol, and so all of those things. But yet there are people out there who are courageously trying different approaches. They're trying to fight back. They're trying to get at some of the core issues driving these challenges that communities are having. And so wanting to dig into a more like a verite current event of what people on the ground were trying to do to solve this. So Tipping the Pain Scale is a film directed by Jeff Riley, who is also produced The Anonymous People and directed Generation Found, a brilliant Emmy Award-winning storyteller. I think he's the best feature documentary editor, and I think John Schinholzer would agree with me, in the country. But so the film is really like an anthology following people at different layers, different walks of life, solving the addiction crisis in their own way. So it's really excited to head down your way in a couple days.
There are, I got a sneak preview, as you know, I got a sneak preview in Las Vegas during Mobilize Recovery. And there are some powerful, powerful stories woven throughout the documentary. And I actually don't even like using the word documentary because it doesn't have, I think of documentaries and I think of very dry, very, this is Nathan, in my opinion. And yet this is such an engaging film. And of course, I'm a person in recovery. So, I mean, it's very relatable, but I think a lot of people can relate regardless of whether they're in recovery or not. What started the project? Did this project, because so much of this project talks about what's been going on during the COVID pandemic, did the project start as a result of COVID, or was this just sort of, I want to say serendipitous, because I think when the books are written 10, 20 years from now, we're going to look at this moment in history and say, this is one of those moments where we captured all the electricity in the bottle. And we said, you know what? We have some solutions, community-based, peer-driven solutions. And when I look at what's been happening around here in Virginia, I think of during the pandemic, the government shutting down, treatment centers turning away people, emergency departments not doing their job to actually help people, while the community-based people in recovery organizations continued to keep the doors open. And so that to me is so incredibly powerful. And that's a lot of what comes through in your story. So the question, which came first, the chicken or the egg, the pandemic or the movie?
No, the pandemic stunted the movie. We started filming in 2019. And so the genesis is there's a guy in South Carolina who spearheaded something called the Chris and Kelly Hope Foundation, a gentleman who's been a good friend of mine and supporter of the cause, Steve Grant. And Steve Grant lost two boys to an overdose. And he was having lunch with our executive producer, Tim Grant, no relation. And Tim had said he wanted to do something on this issue. And the conversation turned to wanting to make a film kind of about, these issues. And Steve said, well, I don't know anything about making a film, but I know a guy. And so Steve connected Tim and I and we met and, timing was serendipitous in my life and looking at the next thing. And Jeff was coming off a 30 for 30. That's Jeff Riley goes between recovery docs and 30 for 30 for ESPN. So that's the level of, as you say, it's like the film is engaging, entertaining. Like this is a highly produced film and feature film. And it's because of Jeff Riley and his talents. But the genesis of that kind of started it. And Jeff said, yeah, you know, I'd love to do something. And so we started researching different people, and we found Roz Picardo, who's doing street outreach.
Is she amazing?
Yeah. Doing unbelievable street outreach on the streets of Kensington, Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. Marty Walsh had always been a target of mine because, you know, since he got elected in, I think, 16, it was, you know, the recovery community who really elected him. And I really wanted to tell that story in a concrete way to inspire others that, you know, look, we are a constituency of consequences. Carol McDade kind of taught me that phrase of needing to become a constituency of consequence. And that's Marty Walsh is the epitome of that, right? Mm-hmm. Of running a tight mayor's race in Boston. And it was the recovery community who put him over the edge. And now he's the Secretary of Labor for the President of the United States. And then, you know, Darren Waller, who's an NFL Pro Bowl tight end. He wasn't that when we started filming with him in 19. He became a starting tight end for the Oakland Raiders then. And then they moved to Las Vegas, and then he had this crazy breakout year. But his story about being an active NFL player, telling his recovery story and how that's impacting the fans, and we were able to kind of track down the you know, a fan and be able to tell that story is really cool because we don't.
That is powerful. Yeah.
Yeah, we don't often get current athletes. We have a number of athletes in recovery who are retired or they're commentators or what have you. We don't actually have people at the epitome, at the apex of their career. I mean, he's quite literally the best tight end in the NFL, arguably with Kelce and Kittle. And, you know, so Tim was able to track him down through some connections in Georgia and through Hunter Renfro and all of that. So we were able to get that story. And then, you know, I met with Lauren Davis probably in like 2018, and I just said, like, your story, like what you're doing is incredible. The state legislator piece, you know, and so I said, I'm working on something. I really think, you know, I want this to be a part of it. And then Joseph Green is just, you know, talk about mic drop. I mean, he's one of the most incredible people I've ever met in this movement, and what he does with young people and what he does, through his art is just, you know, breathtaking. And so I worked with Joseph on the Surgeon General's thing. I've worked with Joseph on a few other things, but this was the first time I was able to help, you know, with Jeff get into his environment in schools and what he does and kind of capture that in those settings. So that was a lot of fun.
We get to have him in Virginia, which is amazing.
Yeah, and Josh is coming. And so mm-hmm. Josh is like this, you know, we were out in Boston, Josh De La Rosa, he's a police officer. We're bringing a police officer to a recovery film, folks. So if you're not coming for the recovery film or the recovery food or whatever Mixion's got in store, come to see a police officer at the recovery film.
You know what, though? You know what? To that point, though, we do get sheriffs at some of our events quite often. And we do get, believe it or not, we get our we don't have district attorneys here. We have Commonwealth attorneys. We get those at our events, too. And I think the Henrico County Commonwealth attorney will be there as well. So she'll be there. But Josh De La Rosa, tell that story, because, man, he is so I love his energy and what he does and the decisions that he has made. To actually try to help in the situation instead of doing the same cycle of lock up and lock up and lock up and repeat. So, yeah, share that, because I that's one of the most incredible pieces.
Yeah, I mean, I won't give away the entire backstory that's in the film, but, you know, he is the street outreach officer, or one of the street outreach officers in the city of Boston. And so he worked under, you know, Marty Walsh and some other folks at throughout the city. But, you know, basically, he was to engage, like, he left, he started in the drug interdiction and police arrests. And his quote in the film is like, you know, my first year, I was able to take a few guns off the street and some drugs off the street. And it was like, but like, I looked at the drug epidemic in the city, and it was like, I was never gonna make a dent. You know, it was just every time I'd take a dealer off the corner, like, tomorrow there's a different dealer on that corner. And I think we all collectively understand that and understand the economics of the drug trade, right? And so his philosophy is like, I need to take away the not the supply side on the streets, but I need to take away the demand side on the streets. And so he started doing street outreach and helping people navigate treatment, and he'll work with the unhoused community and all of that. And so it's been pretty incredible in terms of uncovering that. But, you know, he gets into the engagement center and he does a lot of work. And so it was fun to follow him in what he does on a daily basis, to be in a police car and be able to bring people into that environment, but not in your in like a cops kind of way, you know?
Yeah, right, right.
You're in. It feels like cops in some ways, but like it's like what is coming out of this guy's mouth is like, whoa, he's not a police officer, you know.
Well, it's funny because he was at the Macklemore concert with us, and he was in front of me, like right in front of me the entire time, which had me cracking up because he's there with a tank top on and just dancing and I'm like. It's a police officer right there. But we have a trailer from the movie. Would you like us to show that?
Yeah, let's everyone get to meet Josh and Roz and then we could talk more. Yeah.
Awesome.
It's about this problem because you say it's a pandemic. How did we get to these pandemic proportions?
In the late 1990s, there was a paradigm shift for treating chronic pain.
Let me overdose.
People are ODing anywhere they use.
It's like the country had to hit bottom, where 70,000 folks died, till anybody even said, maybe we're doing something wrong.
Stigma and judgment are keeping people, the disease of addiction, from getting the help they need. And this, in my opinion, is killing more people than overdoses.
Everything that I've done in my life up until this moment was meant for me to be here right now having this conversation with you. Something that I've survived, something that I've lived through, is meant to touch the heart of somebody in this audience.
When you walk up to somebody in the neighborhood, they're like, why are you guys harassing us? And I'm like, hey, I'm not here to harass. This is my role. Look at my cruiser.
Today, I'm gonna show you how to reverse an overdose.
I'm healing by doing something for someone else.
God had me playing football for a reason. It would be a platform to impact other people. I wanna be in the world of changing minds and help people unlock who they really are.
I started learning everything that I could about mental health and substance use disorder, and then everything I could about how laws are made and how laws have changed. We always say, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu.
This issue certainly means a lot to me. I'm in recovery myself, 24 years.
My name is Marty Walsh, and I'm an alcoholic.
I think it's okay for people to know I'm in recovery because it's not a secret.
My name is Joseph Green, and poetry saved my life. I also tried to use poetry to help save lives.
The story is being told as the physical pain crisis led to the opioid crisis, when the real story is that the emotional pain crisis has always been leading to a drug crisis.
There was a quote to individuals experiencing homelessness and active addiction, and it says that the obstacle to my client's engagement in treatment is not an absence of pain, it's an absence of hope.
Wow. Wow.
And I promise it looks better in 2K in the movie theaters than on Zoom. So if it stuttered a little bit for you at home, get out to a movie theater in early 2022 or show up on Monday night and and you'll see it in far more vibrant flowing colors.
Well, that if anything, that's just a testament to how we need to continue to fund the recovery support services here in the Commonwealth of Virginia.
It's not in the herd problem. This is like, you know, film.
No, we need to continue to fund recovery support services in Virginia.
Okay.
Especially the technology. But yes, no, it is absolutely brilliant and beautiful and colorful and not at all choppy. I mean, this is the real deal, folks. And I know Tim Perry's watching. Tim Perry, I think Tim was in Vegas with us watching the show, I believe, watching it live then, or watching the preview then. We're doing a preview here in Henrico County outside of Richmond on Monday. Did you know that, Greg?
I did. My plane tickets are booked, and I am ready to get back to Richmond. It's been a minute. It's been a, you know, I was down there quite a bit and it's been a minute. So I'm really excited to be back there. I think we did do Generation Found and Anonymous People in the same theater. So I really love the venue. Wow. Too. It's a unique thing, right? That it's owned by the county.
Yeah. And it's a beautiful old theater. I haven't actually been inside it yet. So I'm eager to get in there and see the space. And I love the engagement with the community. I believe we're gonna get very close to filling the entire 400 seats in there. I'm very confident in that we'll have a pretty good audience. We'll have a pretty damn good audience in there. You know, we're gonna have free food, so that always helps.
Yeah, come for the food, and we'll slip in a film.
Come for the food, leave with the hope.
Yeah.
But that's what I love about this story. You know, I talk to reporters. We all talk to reporters and people who have an idea of what recovery is or what addiction is, really. And people ask me questions, and I've been getting it a lot lately. Okay, so let's talk about the numbers. Let's talk about the 97,000, the 100,000. Let's talk about the 20-some-odd, the 2,000, the 40% we've gone in Virginia, you know, over overdoses. Let's talk about that. How has COVID exacerbated? I'm like, yeah, I'm sick of that conversation. Yes, we need to continue to have that conversation, but let's talk about what's really going right. These community-based organizations, these on-the-ground, boots-on-the-ground solutions like what we're seeing in your film and the recovery stories that are happening despite all the odds. Yeah. You know, I there's a guy who just celebrated a year in recovery who works here at the McShin Foundation. And I, in a million years, I can't imagine how I would have done that, starting my recovery journey when no meetings were open. You know, when a lot of recovery meant, you know, no access to old timers. And so it's really powerful, these little messages of hope that you're bringing to the table, because we all know the stories of our friends and our loved ones who have suffered. And we want to continue to tell, we need to continue to tell those stories. But just as importantly, we have to tell these stories of recovery, resilience, redemption, hope. And that's what you're doing here. And I love that.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that obviously in addition to COVID, you know, we've also had, you know, a bit of a racial reckoning in this country, and one of the things that was really important to Jeff and I, you know, is not just some of the recovery leader stories and some of the work, but also getting people of color deeply embedded, and so the film really is a very diverse film, and I think that also separates it from a lot of other films that have been made on this issue is getting into the issues that people of color have and how they're working on changes in different communities. And so, and to your point, like, there's still a bunch of films, you know, like Alex Gibney just released, you know, on HBO, you know, The Crime of the Century, and, you know, and Hulu's got The Dope Sick out, and there's, I mean, it's all interesting and helpful to know, like, the origin of the problem. But I think at this point, you know, people have seen the addiction story. It's been told, you know, there's tons of opioid films out there, you know, about people who've lost loved ones and what have you. And they're riveting and gut wrenching to watch. But, you know, at the end of the day, what do I do with that? You know, as a viewer, what do I do with that? And I think that's, you know, for me, you know, storytelling has to have function, has to have purpose. And you know, in the early showing in Mobilize, like you'll remember on that during that Q&A, it was like the coolest Q&A that I'd ever witnessed, because we, you know, this film captures 6 to 8 like really dynamic people doing like incredible stuff, but they're all on the stage after watching each other for the first time in this film.
Yeah.
And to a person, they all wanted to level up. Like what did you like? And Nzinga asked them what they got from each other's story, and it's like Roz wants to run for you know election, and Josh wants to go, you know, start a boxing gym for young people. It's like, it's just like to watch like people who are at what I would call the upper echelon of unbelievable work that they're doing, wanting to level up after seeing each other. So I mean, that's the hope of the project, is that no matter what you're already doing in the community, or if you're not engaged in the community, or you're looking for ways to engage, that there's somebody in this project that you're going to connect with and be like, I can do that. Or I know somebody who does that, and I need to help them amplify their work. You know, or, you know, I don't like my local representative and I'm going to go run and go, you know, change some shit like Lauren's doing, you know.
I want to go change some shit. I love that.
That's exactly.
Storytelling has to have function. James Reed says, good word there. What is the desired outcome from that story? You know, I'm a person in recovery, and I have a story, and I can share my story, and I can tell you about the hardships, and I can tell you what happened, and I can tell you what life is like now. And that life now for me in recovery means life on life's terms, to use 12-step language. It means that I'm going to have good and bad, but at the end of the day, like, I have purpose. And I'm driven, and I get to, like Honesty Liller always says, I get to walk in my purpose. And Honesty, by the way, she says, Greg, thank you for being amazing. She's watching.
Hey, can't wait to see you.
And so I saw that movie, and I love Joseph Green, and I've known his work, and I kind of knew Marty Walsh, and I don't think I knew anybody else in the film, but I knew Joseph Green. I know Joseph Green, and I kind of knew Marty Walsh. And after seeing that and leaving that moment, and of course, we're at Mobilize, so we've got advocates doing incredible work all around the country, all together to say, hey, we have a voice. And here we are at that, like you said, that apex, right, of people doing this incredible stuff at the granular level. And I'm like, you know, I look at like what the Boston cop is doing. I can do that. You know, or I can do what she's doing right there, what Roz was doing. Roz tells this incredible story. She was in my narrative group. So I got to, yeah, I know. Me trying to coach her on her story, that was crazy to me when I realized later who she was. But that, like, these people, like, doing this work who are just like me, I can do that too. And that's what I got a lot from that. And I think that the work that you've done, you know, I know the anonymous people, let's go back to that for a second. The anonymous people was groundbreaking on so many levels. What started your journey on that? Because I was still, you know, I was a person in active addiction when that came out. And so, like, for me, you know, looking back and looking at that and what was going on in my life at that time, you know, I have no idea what I would have done. What drove you to do that work?
It's, you know, I'm a person in recovery since 17. And I think it speaks to the point of, I didn't know about any of this for my first 4 or 5 years of recovery. This is back in the, you know, early 2000s. And I got into a documentary class in college. So I went to college in recovery, and I got into a documentary class at college. And, you know, my documentary teacher basically said, you know, what makes a good documentary is charismatic subjects and access, you know? So at its core, documentary filmmaking really boils down to one thing, and it's about access. And, And I was like, well, I've got, you know, access to some pretty sensational young people, you know, and so let me go try that. And so I went and I filmed some young people in recovery, you know, all in like, you know, anonymous kind of ways. And but they were telling really compelling stories about their recovery. And, you know, my teacher, everybody in the class was like, wow, how did you get them to do that? And I wasn't out about my own story. And I was just like, you know, it's an issue that I care about. But it sparked something in me. And I realized that I had a unique place in society just because of my lived experience. And so, you know, over time, I got more and more interested in storytelling around this issue, because, you know, the longer in recovery you are, the more taxes you pay, and, you know, the more, you know, shame sometimes you feel about your past, not personal, like, shame, but societal shame about, you know, yeah, I was the guy who used to rob and steal and, you know, do those things. And, you know, if I told the people I'm around now, like, what would they think of me? Right. And, you know, and I think, you know, the two like conflicting things, right. And I didn't, you know, I was going into the film world and I wasn't going to share my story. And I met a woman, named Donna Allegata, who's in Connecticut and, you know, is really passionate about youth services. And she took me on a journey of, recovery support and introduced me to Bill White's work. And, you know, and I kind of just started to slowly evolve my own personal thinking around sharing my story. And I landed, you know, in a Faces and Voices of Recovery training in like probably 2007-ish. And it was, you know, Betty Currier and Tom Coderre, you know, teaching me with Pat Taylor. And they gave me the language that I was sitting in that room and I was like, this story needs, I mean, I think, there was a film out, on the HIV, I'm blanking on the name, but there was a film out about like the HIV movement at the time, like a call to action around showing the story of how the HIV movement really, progressed and got what they needed. And I was like, this community needs a film like that. You know, Inconvenient Truth was out and there was other kind of, you know, social issue documentaries. And I was like, these people are on to something pretty foundational. And so I said I wanted to kind of tell their story. And so Pat Taylor took me under, you know, her wing and introduced me to John Schinholzer and Carol McDade. And I, you know, Honesty was coming on the scene at the time. It was really just an incredible journey to sit down with people like William Cope Moyers and Bill White and, you know, sit there and I didn't know much. I really, you know, certainly, approached the project kind of just, you know, what are you guys doing? Why are you doing it? You know, what's the vision? What's the, you know, and it was really like, you know, an opportunity for me to spend hundreds and hundreds of hours with people who just had so much wisdom and then sit with those, like, it wasn't just like that one time experience. Like you in filmmaking, you get to like interview somebody for 2 hours and then you go back and you live with their interview for another year as you're editing. So like really like internalizing the power that they spoke with. And I think what's different, like when you hear Stacia Murphy talk about her recovery journey, you know, 30 years removed from the onset or the end of her active addiction, like there is so much more power in the way that they articulate, communicate, and bring, you know, this conviction around, they boil it down. And so I get tons of credit at the end of the day for anonymous people. Honestly, like it's the people that are in that film that have the power that are sharing their stories with such depth and weight. And so I was just really privileged to be able to do that and go on that journey. And it really, you know, obviously changed the trajectory of my life. And I had no idea that, you know, I honestly was hedging my bets when I was making this as getting a master's at NYU at the time. So this was like my master's thesis project. And then it was like, I was doing like a 10-minute short and that was kind of what I was doing. And then after it was like, oh, this is good. This can be something that I took the next year and I went and finished, you know, worked on the feature and then, you know, got it backed on Kickstarter. And Jeff Riley just said like, yeah, if you get this backed on Kickstarter and people like the McShin Foundation and others supported the film, and we exceeded our goal, we were able to hire Jeff Riley to edit the project. And that's when, you know, the project really became something of depth and weight, I think.
I'm just picturing you, a master's student at NYU, going through that process. It seems and still maintaining your recovery at the same time. That's incredible. Now, I know that filmmaking is a passion of yours, and I know because, you know, I talk to you, but I see you in different spaces, which means I know that's not your only gig as a filmmaker. So do you mind sharing other work that you do? Is that off the table? Is that on the table?
No, absolutely. So my day job is actually as a managing director of Third Horizon Strategies. It's something I've been doing the last couple years. And it's you know, consulting and advising and just trying to, you know, stay involved and connected to these issues. You know, one area of interest when I got my master's was always health finance. And I, you know, going around the country, it's like, what can I add? You know, what can I add to this movement? And, you know, one area that I feel like I'm interested in and can add is around like the core problem that so many folks, RCO leaders have around the country, which is how do we scale this stuff? How do we buy this stuff in a way that makes sense for recovery? And historically, addiction services have been bought in this, you know, fee for service. You go to detox once, you know, the detox gets paid. You come out and have a reoccurrence of symptoms, you know, and you go back to detox, the detox gets paid again. And again, and it's like, even as good as the facility is or the program is or as good as the people who work at these programs are, they're set up for failure because they're perversely incentivized because Ooh. You know, because if somebody fails, you do better, but if somebody stays well, you do worse. Like fundamentally it's just broken and it doesn't make any sense for the nature of the condition. And so we call this a chronic illness. We call this a chronic disease, just like diabetes, just like cancer, just like heart disease. And we have these sound bites and they're good, but yet we don't buy the thing the way that other chronic diseases are starting to get bought. You know, which we buy this thing like knee surgery. You know, and it's like, you know, the knee surgeon screws up on your knee, he gets to do it again and again and again, right? Like, it's just, we're starting to tell knee surgeons you can't do that anymore. But, right. but like, this is like, we don't buy it from a perspective of wellness. And so I've been managing something called the Addiction Payment, or the Addiction Alliance for Addiction Payment Reform. And it's like, managed care organizations and health systems and recovery leaders and subject matter experts. And it's a way to try to create more cohesiveness in and longitudinal payment structures. And so I do a lot of work on that. And then at the same time, I've gotten an opportunity this year to work with the RCO community around a recovery set aside in the block grant and advocate at the national level around that. And one other piece that I'm really excited about now is Jeff and I, as we are finishing tipping the pain scale, we were approached by an organization called High Watch Recovery, which is the oldest nonprofit in the addiction space. And it was founded by Bill Wilson and Marty Mann in 1939. And they wanted to find a pathway for us to continue to tell these stories and produce these stories. And so we kind of unveiled that at Mobilize Recovery. But we're working on a number of projects now through High Watch Media. So yeah, I get to work across a number of things, keep my right brain and left brain engaged. But you know, this payment stuff takes a long time. So I'm buckled in for the long haul there, but it's trying to, you take Bill White's work, you take Carol's work on parody, you take on all these things that have happened, and how do you take these points of leverage and knowledge and move the system forward? So,
and you know, I'm in some of those conversations about the bad, and it's not, for, I guess, for lack of a better term, it's not the sexiest subject to dive into. And yet I'm so grateful that you are so passionate about that, because I find the more I get into it, I am so increasingly interested in it, but frustrated and angry. You know, when we're sitting there arguing between, and for people who are listening, when Greg's talking about a set aside in the block grant, he's talking about the federal block grant that goes to each state that covers substance abuse. What is the grant called? Substance abuse treatment block grant. Prevention and treatment block grant. Right. Yeah. And so for the first time ever this year, it was proposed in Biden's budget that 10% of that block grant, while the block grant got a huge increase, 10% of that should be set aside for recovery support services. Going another step further, a Congresswoman, Abigail Spanberger, who represents Virginia's 7th District, where I'm sitting right now, she put in a bill that would make that permanent. And now I'm hearing from the meetings I'm attending, you know, there's some friction from the treatment centers and the this and the that, and people worried about losing their funding here and the states and the this and the, and is it going to be 10%? Is it going to be 5%? Shouldn't it be 20% since prevention's getting 20%? So it's kind of like, geez, already people are dying, you know, let's freaking come together and stop getting so stuck in that. And yet, so
yeah, I mean, it's, look, system transformation and advocacy is not for the faint of heart. You know, it's my, one of my favorite lines, you know, Station Murphy, you know, advocacy is about anger, you know, and I'm glad you're angry. Right. And other people should be angry because it's not working. Like, you know, another $1 billion, another $2 billion, like the government could keep printing money, throwing it exactly the same way it's been throwing it for 30 years. It's not going to change. I mean, it's not going to change. Like, it's time to try some different things. Right. And we have some promising practices, and we know, you know, some of the core gaps in our communities right now, front end engagement, long term sustainability of any clinic. And we've improved our clinical offerings. But like, you know, clinical treatment and, you know, and my, even my recovery housing, I mean, I'm in recovery 20 years. It was 4 months of my 20 year experience.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's just like you have to right size that at some level. And, you know, and I think we have to be okay, you know, with people not liking us or being upset. Like, when you hear those things that the treatment community is upset or this community is upset at this, because it might, you know, change somebody's perception, that means we're doing something.
Yeah.
Like if people aren't angry at you, or if you're not getting incoming from somebody with the advocacy work that you're doing, you need to be pushing harder.
I like that. Well, Greg, putting this all into one big package and getting to tipping the pain scale and stories and having function in storytelling, for individuals who are out there, maybe new to recovery, and many of the people who will be watching the sneak preview, the free sneak preview on Monday, will be new to recovery. What do you suggest, or what advice or suggestions do you give to somebody new, or anybody who wants to tell their story? As how do we make it more impactful? That's my question. I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah, I think what was impressed upon me by, you know, that first training I ever went on, it, you know, it's for years that the 12-step community had this idea of people who went public about their recovery that it was ego driven, and that it would, that people were just doing it to be about themselves. And I think the difference, right, and the core difference is there's plenty of people who do that, right? And they stand up and it's about themselves. The core difference is what is your purpose for telling your story, right? And when Carol's out there trying to get people to advocate for parity, or putting folks on camera for this film, the folks that we chose to follow, they're not telling their story, you know, so that they, their star gets brighter. They're doing something, they're telling their story to drive impact in their community. And I think it's really important for us, you know, to balance, you know, the purposeful or the intention behind telling the story. And if you know your audience and you know your intention, you know, going in, it impacts, you know, the motivation for telling the story. And so I think that's the most important thing. And then I also think that, you know, discrimination is real. And a lot of people ask me, like, you know, what if I'm not ready? Or what if I'm, you know, something happens in my life for telling my story. And I'm of two minds on this. Like, people need to be engaging at the level that they're comfortable with, and they need to have good mentorship and good coaching around that. So it's not, you know, not everybody needs to be at the state legislature 2 weeks in their recovery telling their story. And we need to have really good coaching around that. On the flip side, like, the only reason I'm sitting here talking to you and the only reason I do this work is because of, you know, something that Donna said to me. I was 5 years in my recovery. I just talked at my legislature and I told the Hartford Courant, you can't use my last name. And it was like a nice story about this kid, 17-year-old kid, former drug addict who is in recovery. But 4 lines into the story, it's Greg W. didn't want to disclose his last name. And I told Donna, well, you know, Google, and like, what, you know, what if people knew, and, you know, what if people find you, you know, and I'm trying to be in the film business and all of this. And she's like, well, if recovery is really important to you and somebody's going to close a door in your life as a result of that, is that a door you want opened? And that hit hard, you know, that hit really hard. And if recovery is really important to you and you're worried about being discriminated against, I think that's a really important question. And obviously this is coming from a white heterosexual male with all the privilege and all of that. And I fully appreciate that not everybody can respond to that question the same way that I was able to respond to it. But I think it's a really important question, and your family. You know, I hadn't talked to my family because it does, you know, telling your story at a public level does impact your family, and they need to understand what your purpose and why. And so those two considerations, but I think it's really important to reflect on our purpose and our intent.
Awesome. I do have one other question about the movie. And my question goes to, I believe there are two individuals who are allies in the movie. Was that a conscientious effort when you were choosing people to be in the, to weave narratives through, or did it just come about organically? Because I think that's really incredible that two of those stories are stories of from allies, you know, advocating and doing incredible work in the recovery space.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, this isn't, you know, this issue isn't going to, it takes a village. I mean, I think that's the ultimate message of the film. Like, this takes a village and layers, you know, like, everybody can easily talk about what the federal government should be doing. But, you know, from the federal government to the state government to the streets, you know, this takes layers of change. You know, I wish everyone's like, oh, what's your answer to solve it all? And it's like, you know, I wish it was simple, but I mean, it's time to acknowledge it's not simple. This is complex and it's complicated and it's multifactorial. So how we talk about it, how we tell stories about it, and who we raise up as examples, powerful examples, needs to be multifactorial and layered.
I've been very, very fortunate and completely by accident to have found myself in my recovery journey at the McShin Foundation. You know, my recovery journey began with a jail program run by the McShin Foundation. And I was mandated by the courts to come to Richmond, an hour and a half from Northern Virginia, where I lived in DC. But I came down here thinking I'd be here for 28 days, 30 days. I'd be right back in Northern Virginia figuring out the next step in my life and how to get past the new felony that I had for my possession charge. And, you know, of course, that was almost 4 years ago. So, you know, something clicked. And when I get to have these conversations, this is probably my favorite part of my job, is when I get to do these things and talk to not only filmmakers like you. And this is one of these weeks where I've had an award-winning filmmaker and a New York Times bestselling author on the show. And probably, I love those conversations, but I also, like, we get to have new people in recovery. Like, the little bit of whatever sparked in me when I was first here, you know, I get to share that with a new person. And whether they take it or not, you know, other people around here also have those sparks. And so it's like, you know, the community that's been started here, that's been fostered here, you know, by Carol, by John, by Honesty and Jesse and the people who've been here for a while. And then, you know, these new people who come in and suddenly it's a huge impact. It's really beautiful. And, you know, to see that this is not only rich, I had no idea what recovery was. When I got into recovery, I thought recovery was a cult of people sitting in a church basement, chain smoking cigarettes and whining about their lives, drinking bad coffee. And it's not. In fact, I've had so much fun, you know, in my you know, three, almost 4 years journey of being in recovery now. And so I don't know how I got to this point. And I don't know how any of us got to this point, but I am so grateful to be in these spaces with incredible people like you and get to share these stories and hopefully empower others to share theirs as well.
It's awesome that McShin, you know, supports, I mean, all of this stuff for you but the storytelling on a broader community. It's one of the bright RCOs out there that really, you know, reaches people beyond Richmond and beyond their community. And so I'm so grateful to the McShin Foundation for supporting this new film, supporting the former films, participating in our projects and you know, providing you this platform, because the next frontier, you know, for the herd needs to be about innovation. We need to be breaking silos and walls and trying new things and throwing stuff against the wall and seeing what sticks.
Oh, my mom says that all the time. I love that. Throw the spaghetti at the wall and see what sticks.
Throw $1 billion out of the community and you know, the same way we've been doing it. And it's like, you know, so.
Do you have any, before I ask that question, James Reed says, I'm a pastor in long-term recovery and yes to the church, one of the layers. Despite losing a son to the opiate epidemic, I still believe we can and do recovery. There is hope. Thanks for the work you are doing. Thanks, James. Thank you for listening. Both Tom Jackson and Honesty, you know, Honesty, of course. I think you probably know Tom. Can't wait to see you on Monday, as I cannot wait to see you on Monday. I think it's going to be exciting. I know it's going to be exciting to be able to be in that space. Joseph Green is on the show for a special Get in the Herd on Monday at 2 p.m. I know that's going to be engaging and fire. We're going to have him on the show, and then he's going to actually do a group here with our participants at 3:15. So it's going to be an electric day. And then we go right to Thanksgiving, and I'm baking Empire biscuits for my grandmother, and I'm excited about that. You know, that's what recovery gives me these days. And so, you know, keeping in mind, as I asked this last question to you, Greg, our biggest audience are individuals who are currently experiencing incarceration. And they, you know, we take this platform and we give it to Paytel for free, and they distribute it for free to, I think, 48 different jails and prisons across the Commonwealth. What would you say, you know, what do you say to them who are dealing with the consequences of this, all of this, who are currently experiencing those consequences? And any final thoughts before we end the hour?
Yeah, well, that's so cool that that audience is able to engage with your work and this work. I've learned more about criminal justice, recovery oriented criminal justice, you know, interventions through McShidden than probably anywhere in the country. And the system is just broken, but you know, the kinds of things that I've witnessed from incarcerated individuals, from, you know, developing music to at Mobilize Recovery, we had a woman who's currently incarcerated, like zoom in, and she's part of the advocacy community. And, you know, there's power in that. I'm writing a pardon letter for my best friend right now, who's been in recovery 15 years, and his felony charge from 15 years ago is still following him. You know, he's got a great business, and you know, it's just sad what we have to do. And so we passed a law in Connecticut to expunge records. And so I think one of the biggest things, you know, is obviously, you know, those individuals who are leaving soon, you know, make sure that you're set up for success. And then, you know, follow on day one, you know, ask your probation officer on day one, ask people around you, like, what is the pathway to a pardon in my state? What is the pathway to, you know, eliminate my record? And if that pathway is too long, go change the law, because that's ridiculous. You serve your time, and then we're going to keep you locked within the justice system for decades after you sustain your recovery is just fundamentally so flawed. 63 million Americans have a criminal record in this country. And that is just what we do to people in terms of discrimination around that. Talk about things that anger me. But every state needs to change their laws around that, because people recover and they should not be held back in their life after they've done, served their time, done what they've needed to do, accomplished what they've needed to do. They should not be held back anymore.
You're awesome, Greg. I appreciate you. Will we see you December 3rd for the DC rally? The rally at the Justice Department, the Department of Justice. Boy, I didn't mean to talk about that today, but here we are. The Department of Justice rally on December 3rd, which is a Friday at 11 p.m. in front of the Department of Justice. We're going to sit there and we're going to keep telling the Department of Justice to do their freaking job and prosecute the bastard, the Sackler family, you know, who have been a cause of so much suffering and have gotten off scot-free while many of our friends are dead or harmed or are dealing with the consequences of a justice involvement. So criminal justice involvement. So will we see you then?
Unfortunately, I got to go with Joseph to Charleston, South Carolina. We got another sneak preview show, but I will stand with you and support. I was in Stanford and some of the rallies there. But keep fighting the fight, and we need to continue to press on, DOJ to do the right thing.
Greg, thank you for being with us today, and thank you everybody watching and listening to the show today. To close out today this week, I do want to remind everybody, next week on the show, in the herd, we have Joseph Green. He is a spoken word artist who is featured in the soon-to-be award-winning film, Tipping the Pain Scale. We're going to have Joseph Green here on the show talking about the show, the movie, the his life, what he does. He's fire. He is fire. And the conversation will be as engaging as this, I guarantee. Going forward, we have on November 30th at 7:30 p.m., we have another special after hours edition of Get in the Herd. We have Representative Abigail Spanberger, who represents the 7th District here in Virginia. John Carroll and I are going to be on the show with her in the herd, talking about that 10% set aside and recovery support services and why that is so important. If you have any questions about what we're doing here today, my email is nathanm@mcshin.org. I will be glad to talk to you about the preview that we got on Monday, talk about the rally in D.C. on December 3rd, and all the other stuff that we've got going on. Thank you again, Greg. Thank you, everybody listening and watching. Thank you, Justin, for being our producer today. And we will see you on Monday. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you. Take it easy.
Liller. I am the CEO of the McShen Foundation and a woman in long-term recovery. Since May 27, 2007, I have not used drugs or alcohol. Woo-hoo! Thank you so much to the Richmond Times-Dispatch and all of our voters for getting the Herd podcast. Those podcasts are amazing. Not only has it helped thousands upon thousands of people in their recovery, as well as family members, but it has helped me in my personal recovery. I get to listen to them now in my car through Spotify and iHeartRadio. And it's just really, really important for us to be innovative in the addiction field and the recovery community. So when COVID hit, we had to be innovative. You know, we really had to think of like, what can we do to reach people that cannot go to 12-step meetings, smart recovery, faith-based, whatever, that we're shutting down constantly. So we were innovative here at McShen. Let's start podcast. So with Todd, John, Alex, and some other staff, you know, we all just kind of jumped in who can do what. And with Todd's lead and John's lead, the podcasts have been amazing and we're still doing them today. So I want to thank you for all of your votes and all of your energy and all of your support of our mission of healing families and saving lives. Thanks.